In October 2019, the first ever International Conference on Environmental Peacebuilding was convened by the Environmental Peacebuilding Association at the University of California at Irvine. More than 250 people from 40 countries attended, practitioners, researchers, journalists, donors, policymakers, students, and activists. You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. Over the next few weeks, we'll be featuring interviews with experts, practitioners, and leaders on environmental peacebuilding captured by ECSP on the edges of the conference. I'm Lauren Reese, and in today's episode, we'll hear from Mishkat Al-Mumin, an Iraqi lawyer who served as Iraq's first environment minister in the interim government in 2004. Mishkat, it's an honor to be speaking with you today. You are Iraq's first environment minister, and to date, the way you've lived your life really shows a dedication to human rights and a recognition of the important role that environment plays in conflict and peace. I'd love to start by asking you to tell us a bit about the path that's brought you here to the first international conference on environmental peacebuilding.
Thank you so much, Lauren. I really appreciate the opportunity, and it's my pleasure to talk to you today. I started my career in Iraq. I started as an attorney representing women and workers seeking compensation. That might sound like an easy summary, but in reality, being accepted at the law school was really not that easy. And I will always remember my first class at the law school. The criminology professor entered the class, and he immediately looked at the 10 women out of the 100 sitting in the front row, and he said, "What are you women doing here? Go to the nursing school." I am so glad that I did not go to the nursing school. I kind of continued, completed my legal studies, and then earned my master's degree. I was the only female student studying among four or five male students, the same when I earned my PhD. Around 2003, I became a law professor after the law school decided to get rid of the provision that was always there in their ad jobs. The provision used to say only male candidates will be considered. That struggle, you know, helped me see what women go through in the workplace. In the personal arena, so to speak, I stood up for myself against an abusive husband, and I represented myself in court and obtained full custody of my son. That was the beginning of the single mom struggle in Iraq, which was not easy at all. After the fall of Saddam's regime, I joined the women movement to advocate for more women's rights and more protection of these rights, more laws that protect women's rights. Throughout all of that, I came to see the connection between women and the environment, another neglected topic, so to speak, in Iraq. And I'm not sure until this moment whether neglected topics they choose me to advocate for or I choose them to advocate for. But, you know, I came to see firsthand what women can do when they are recognized as the primary users of environmental resources, water, electricity, and so on. Then I was selected by the UN envoy to Iraq to become the first environment minister of Iraq. Iraq did not have a department to protect the environment. And my job and mandate at the time was to put the department all together. The ministry had the second lowest budget throughout the cabinet.
Which one had the lowest?
Human rights, of course. So, you know, while it was odd to establish a ministry to protect human rights, so usually, you know, you want NGOs and independent organizations to protect human rights, but because Iraq did not have them at the time, you know, it was only fit to establish an organization within the government to try to promote that. Iraq had massive environmental issues, including, you know, the genocide against, or the eco-genocide against the marshlands, the pollution that is, you know, inherited from all the wars that Iraq went through. And the budget was $7 million, that's it, including salaries and, you know, other expenses. Throughout my term, I helped raise funds to fund a lot of environmental projects, including waste management, environmental impact assessment, drafting the first environmental law in Iraq. I also came to work with different groups, the marginalized groups, to provide them with access to safe drinking waters. And that work was across ethnic lines. I think working with women and working across ethnic lines kind of put me in a danger. In August of 2004, I survived a serious attempt over my life. Four of my bodyguards were killed. They were sitting next to me in the same car that I was in. I managed to escape safely with the rest of my bodyguard. Nevertheless, I still suffer from trauma issues related to that particular incident. My son was targeted too. He was 9 at the time. So at some point, I had to kind of put an end to all of that. I applied to the Kennedy School of Government and was accepted. And then I joined the Environmental Law Institute as a visiting scholar. I finally had the chance to sit down and examine from an academic point of view the connections between environmental policies and conflict. I came across very interesting findings to include if environmental policies are designed in a way that deprive certain people from access to the environmental resource, then a conflict will arise. Most policies in the Middle East, Iraq included, Afghanistan, Lebanon, Syria, they prohibit an action from taking place. However, they don't tell you how the resource itself will be managed. So, for example, in Afghanistan, the policy prohibits all timber cutting, which sounds wonderful. However, it does not tell you how timber is being managed. Similarly, in Iraq, smuggling oil is punishable by the capital punishment. And the Constitution says the oil is owned by all Iraqi people. However, the Constitution does not tell you how oil is being managed and who owns it. All this provokes violence. You see, people will have their own interpretation of what the Constitution or the policy should say, and then they will fight over it. And I dedicated all my research for that purpose. I do my research independently. It's not funded by anybody. I'm grateful to the support that I receive from the Environmental Law Institute and from the Environmental Peace Building Association to publish it, to allow other people to read it, and I'll continue to contribute that way.
That's wonderful. You also founded the Women an environment organization in Iraq. That kind of ties back to your to the story about August 2004, and that was in part in reaction to your advocacy for women's rights. Is that right?
That is right. You know, even though I left Iraq, I tried to continue contribute to the cause that I believe in. I believe if you acknowledge women as primary users of environmental resources, if you draft the policy with women on the table, offering you their, you know, unique perspective and unique feedback, you're gonna have a more stable policy, a policy that get implemented. Once you deprive women from that position, then the conflict will arise. I'll give you an example in a story. Women do walk, especially rural women. They walk 9 to 10 miles daily to collect water. On their way to the water resource, they see a lot of suspicious activities. They have no one to report to. So there is a huge connection, a nexus between you know, the role of women as primary users of the water resource and promoting security. If you look at the current policy implemented in Iraq, there is no recognition whatsoever. As such, you don't have stability, you don't have peace, you cannot build or make peace. You know, and that connection is missed. And oftentimes the issue is being Iraq issue, is being approached as a political conflict, an ethnic conflict, not as a conflict regarding environmental resources and how to manage them. As such, you know, if you can imagine a patient who has a flu and the doctor keeps giving him cortisone to recover, or expose him to radiation, chemical radiation, it's not the answer. So the answer to the problems that you see in the Middle East is not political. It's not having, you know, agreements among the conflicting parties. It's basically drafting policies that will allow people, ordinary people, to access environmental resources equally. That's the other part. If you deprive a group and allow another group, then you are creating a conflict. You are promoting conflict using the policy as a tool.
Mishka, what are some of the barriers you see missing in discussions of women's empowerment and leadership and their connection to environmental considerations?
Generally speaking, in the Middle East, women's issues is translated to be breast cancer. That's it.
Okay.
And, you know, women should not have any opinion regarding politics, regarding policy making. It's not their position, period. They should be at home, feeding children, cleaning the house, taking care of a husband. That's it. And in Iraq, for example, the unemployment rate among women is 12%, which is considered the highest in the region. Unfortunately, policy is being drafted by men. As such, you have one point of view, one direction, versus multiple directions and covering multiple topics. The other barrier that I see is that in the Middle East generally, we draw policies from the past. So regardless of who's in office, if he wants to draft a policy, he would look to see the person before him. What did he do? And try to follow his lead. So rather than looking forward, we look backwards. And this is true in cases of Iraq, Afghanistan, Lebanon, Syria, you name it, that's the way. To kind of give you an example, the Ottoman Empire, you know, ruled ages ago in the Middle East. However, we still have policies dates back to the Ottoman Empire. To move forward, we need to take fresh new stands and acknowledge that time has changed. You cannot rule with an iron fist. You cannot rule with an absolute policy that punishes everything with capital punishment or cruel punishment. You need to be pragmatic. You need to look at things and examine them, examine the challenges with fresh eyes. I truly believe the answer to stability is public administration and good management. It has nothing to do with politics and who's in power and how he rules. It has to do with how you enable people and empower them to take charge of their daily life. If people are powerless, then, you know, day-to-day management is impossible. So you need to involve them in your policy, give them a role, regardless of their gender. Men and women should have a say in the way resources are managed, so as you can have a full perspective of what's going on.
So how do you do that? How can you create an enabling environment for women's participation and more broadly other marginalized populations in creating policies and providing direction?
Honestly, you allow them a room to contribute. And today with our modern technology, it's very easy to allow a room for an input. I think local governance is a very important concept that needs to be implemented. It's time to move away from the central government and the way things managed at the central level. I'm not saying, you know, we should not have a central government. Definitely you should have one. But things should be done locally. And you have to have different venues, many venues for people to contribute, including, you know, city halls and town halls, NGOs, online. It's the government job to solicit people's opinion and open up venues for them to participate. Otherwise, you know, that disconnect will continue forever and violence will be the answer all the time we have a problem.
I remember at the Wilson Center a number of years ago, we hosted a workshop on community resilience and how to build community resilience. And space at the table was a big part of that. You know, giving people space, giving them a voice, giving them time to contribute, and making sure that it was they felt safe in doing so.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Mishkat. It's wonderful to meet you and to see you here.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Friday Podcast from the Environmental Change and Security Program. For more information, follow us on Twitter at New Security Beat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.